Hello, everybody. Chris, how are you doing, man? Who else is in here? Cole, Andrew. How's it going, boss?
Very good for me. Very good for me. What about yourself?
Good, man. How was your how was the conference? Like, you did a lot of talking, eh? People love the fudge.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, it's a very large conference. A lot of people aren't aware it's the largest fitness conference in North America. So
Recording in progress.
some of you don't know that's where I was on the weekend presenting at this CanFit Professional conference. And I presented on four different topics. And yeah, some people like it, I guess. So it's good.
It's crazy, man. When did you first start doing like the any presentations? When was your first one?
Probably 12, 13 years ago, Good Life, the company that I worked for in fitness, would ask me to talk about coaching practices or different modalities and stuff to some of the trainers in these large group settings. And then it just kind of, snowballed from there.
That's crazy, man.
Crazy, man.
Like, I know it sounds like a redundant question, but do you like it still?
Yeah, I think someone's some reason there was a voice echo going on. I think it's gone now.
Was fantastic. Who is it? Is it Sarah? Sarah, are you muted? No? Doesn't matter. Do you still like doing it though, Chris?
I love doing it. I get an absolute high and a rush from it. You put together a product or a presentation, and you can foresee what's going to happen. And for some of you that know me, if I coach you or if you're friends through the coaching staff, you'll understand I have a unique sense of humor. Some might call it dry, and I use it a lot in my presentations. So there's always these setups, right, all the time. And for me, I find that very entertaining. Whether anyone else does or not, I tend to do that. So for me, I get a rush off the presentations and then getting to kind of be myself up there, do my thing.
That's amazing. Well, good for you, man. That's awesome. How about you, Andrew? Have you ever done anything like that?
Not too much, man. I've done a little bit, but nothing. Not a big podium guy myself. Keith would know.
Takes courage, dude. It takes a lot of courage. I don't know. It's not for everybody, but yeah, everybody. I think people are still funneling in here, but welcome, everybody. If there's anybody new, of course, please pop in. Who am I seeing on here right now that I can just look through? Jamie, I think you were here last week, yeah? Gabe, you were? Victor, unmute yourself, buddy. This is your first call?
Yep, here.
No,
I was here
what's
last week.
popping? Not my first call. What's popping, guys? How's it going?
It is going well, man.
Wow.
Who's your coach?
Andrew.
Andrew? How are things going so far?
Can't complain, no. Things are going well. We're getting to know each other, and yeah, I mean, I think we're hitting strides and improving.
Awesome, man. What brought you to work here?
So Ben, I was buying supplements, and I think like somebody on like a forum mentioned him, and like I was like leaning towards like what everybody was leaning towards, Athlean X, and like I didn't want to go to the mainstream, like everybody in that a couple years ago like was he was like a big online presence, but I kind of went with him because I have like a bodybuilding background, so like he was more like my background, and so I kind of felt like he had a Zen approach, which I liked, and I kind of liked his style, and I seen him change his trajectory of the way that he's been doing things throughout the years and kind of geared towards like longevity and things like that, so really psyched about learning how the body can improve through time despite age, and beating I guess mother time or whatever it's called that. But yeah, but father time or whatever, father time. But I think it's mental, because once you start defeating yourself upstairs, then you're really aging
Oh.
up, like a lot more fast. than other people.
I couldn't agree more, man. I just had a conversation with a client about that today. We were talking about like the similarities amongst people who see results and about how you can like literally will yourself into progress, or because of like negative self-talk or stress or all this stuff going on, you can deter that. And it's crazy because like if you actually look at people just from the fitness and health side, people who are generally fit, they're just, generally pretty happy, not stressed people, right? So it's kind of weird that you'd think that's like, hey, just don't be grumpy would be such a good piece of information, but it's true. It's a little easier said than done, obviously, but there's some merit. But dude, welcome. It's awesome. Juan, I think that you said that you were new. Q and unmute yourself, buddy, and just say hi. There, man? No? Well, when you can, unmute yourself and say hi. Otherwise, Michael, welcome. Guys, I dropped the coach as a message earlier. I'm hoping you got that. One of the things I wanted to kind of pop on here today and talk about was just some frequently asked questions that we get because, well, selfishly, I think it's good for us to kind of just say them out to a lot of people because we get asked them often. So I think it'd be a good disinformation for everybody to hear. But beyond that, I think that it's really good information we can start a conversation around. And so what I asked the coaches to do was to think about some questions that they individually get asked, because one of the things, actually, to relay on your point there, Vic, one of the things that you'll find is that you're not like, for her Ben says, you're not alone in your struggles, right? We all share the same things. And so when you hear that, like we all ask the same questions, we've heard the same questions, and hearing it from different points of view, hearing the answers from different coaches and how they direct, the solutions or the actionables with their own clients, I think that'd be really interesting. So I just thought of four quick ones myself. And then if the coaches can be so kind and kind of share theirs and kind of pipe in after I'm done, I'd love that. So guys, I'm just going to share my screen quickly here. So if I'm not sure who I'm going to have on there, but I'm going to see if I can do it with actually seeing you guys pop in the chat. So if before I do, I'm going to ask you a question. If you can, everybody in the group right now, just think of anything you'd like to ask. And if you can, just pop it in the chat there, or just make sure that you hold on to it and then ask me once I'm done sharing my screen. Because I would like to make sure that we open this up to be kind of like a roundtable conversation after, because having these questions answered is really important. One of the things I've found, not even necessarily through the coaching experience at MI here, but just through being like a PT and a coach over the adult portion of my life, is that sometimes there's nuance to questions that it's a little bit hard to answer in just like a text message. And when the coach experience is primarily done online, we don't get this opportunity to have a conversation about something as simple as like, cardio or stretching or things like that, right? So if you can just think about that and then just ask me once I'm done. So I'm gonna share my screen. Let me see if I can do it. Okay, everybody can see that, yeah. So again, very, very simple conversation, but I do want you guys to feel free just to unmute yourself and just elaborate on it and ask me, ask the coaches, pipe up if you have any questions. Okay. So the first thing I wanted to address was zone two or walking, because it's such a simple concept. It's such a, almost a boring thing. And a lot of people I find, they ask me, it's like, why do we do so much walking? Why do coaches always prescribe walking? Why do we talk about zone two so much? Right. And again, it's such a gigantic answer that it's not as simple as just get your steps in. Not all steps are created equal. How many guys have like a step counter? You guys have a step counter on you, like some kind of Whoop or Oura Ring or something like that. I don't know how you do it with the Oura Ring unless you put it on your big toe. But sometimes I'll put this thing on my ankle and I'll just see how many steps I get. And it's very different than if you actually go intentionally walking, because like you're just doing steps across the day if you're walking through your kitchen. So you can already see how if you were just kind of tracking your steps through the day versus going out intentionally hiking, those two step counts are now completely different in how they're going to have effect on your fitness, right? Because one is like, hey, I'm chasing my cat. The other one's I'm hiking through, a jungle. So obviously very different. But the whole point of walking, why I personally prescribe it, there's numerous health benefits. Like you can obviously read ahead of me there, but the benefits I'm trying to like knock over a bunch of stones with one throw, right? I'm trying to tackle hip movement, spinal movement, making sure you're getting proper diaphragmatic expansion, trying to make sure that you're, trying to aid in your recovery from your sessions, regulating blood sugar. It helps with need expenditures. So need expenditures, Essentially what that's doing is it's like you have a certain amount of calories you're burning per day. This is going to help you achieve a certain amount of that, just so we can understand that when it comes down to either putting you in a calorie surplus or a deficit, we understand where that is. Because sometimes people think that a calorie deficit or surplus is just like a number. Like if I was to say to you guys, hey, 1500 calories, I bet you a massive amount of you would probably say that's a calorie deficit. Well, maybe not. Maybe if you guys just binge watched like Twisted Metal, that's the new one, right? If you guys, then probably that's not a calorie deficit anymore. That's probably a calorie surplus. And that's actually one of the biggest things that we struggle with when it comes down to making sure people don't put themselves back into like a calorie surplus when we actually give them low calories. Because the first thing people want to do is actually just drop their movement. So doing something that regulates need expenditure is gonna, something like walking is gonna really help us. Because then if I know that you're burning, let's say 300 calories from your workout, another 300, from steps, you're getting this many calories, then I can basically say to a T, hey, this guy needs fine line of, let's say, 1578 calories in order to lose weight. So it's a really cool process, because I know that if I get my client to do this, it just comes down to adherence. It's like he's getting the results he wants if his goal is weight loss, and vice versa. If his goal is weight gain, then it's obviously you got to eat more. You got to eat more. And it's the opposite process, right? But the whole point with this, without ranting, because you can obviously see it, we can have a whole presentation on zone two and walking alone, but there are so many benefits to walking. What I've found, and Chris, I'd like to actually kind of hear your opinion on this too. Over the course of time that I've kind of experimented with bodybuilding, some powerlifting, weightlifting, there's been like this undertow of mobility kind of in the back of your head that you always have to pursue. And you get caught in the stretching trap where you're just stretching all the time. People do it. And don't get me wrong, there's some merit in it. But what I find is kind of a trick about stretching is that it kind of lops you into the thought that you have to do it, and you kind of like miss the forest for the trees, so to speak. And what I'm trying to say is that, you can accomplish so much more in walking. You get your hips mobile, you can actually get moving, you provide your body with so many other benefits. And so what I'd like to know from Chris is, like, do you see the same benefits with your actual high level athletes? If you give them something like walking, I'd say, hey, I need you to make sure that you're getting, I don't know, let's just say either like 30 minutes or 12,000 steps a day of actual walking, that you see their hips clear up. They have to spend less time in recovery.
That's a really good point, and you just hit the nail on the head with that. The walking offers more benefits than what people think, because people think walking is just walking. Just the idea of doing locomotion, put one foot forward and then the opposite arm goes backwards, and then you constantly do that over and over again, you're creating this sling-like effect with your body. So certain muscles are going to contract, other muscles are going to relax at the same point. So you're getting a little bit mobility through the hips. The lower limbs, you're going to get some plantar flexion. So you're going to be training your Achilles tendon, your gastroc, and the Achilles tendon for us men, once you get over that 30, 40, 50, that bastard gets pretty stiff on you. And a lot of times it gets stiff because people aren't using it. So just the concept of walking and consciously pressing through your big toe as you step, what you're going to do, you're going to contract the tissues around it. And the Achilles tendon is avascular. It does not have a direct supply of blood flow. So you have to move the tissues around it to juice it up a bit. And that's what walking will do. If you're stiff, if you're one of the stiffies and you got a stiff low back and stuff, just the idea of walking and swinging your arms. Here's a bonus here. Walk kind of like a march with your arms swinging, as goofy as it looks. What it does is it creates a lot of micro rotations between the vertebrae, right from the cervical spine all the way down the lumbar spine. And those micro rotations, not under load, are really good for decompressing the spine. The world's greatest back expert, or one of the back experts, Dr. Stu McGill, who was recently on Ben's podcast. He's the guy who researches all this stuff. I've had the privilege of doing a mentorship with him many years ago. And he says, we take people in back pain, who have back pain, and they fail all these tests for muscular endurance. They fail these tests for bracing abilities. There are high rates of pain. And we just give them protocols of 10-minute walks a day, every day. And you start seeing all those scores improve. Pain goes down, endurance goes up, back pain is reduced. And he's like, it's all that little micro movement because things are getting too stiff, too stiff. So walking's phenomenal for lower limb health. Walking's phenomenal for back health and hip health. Walking is phenomenal for a little caloric expenditure. You like that Tim Hortons muffin? Tim Hortons is a Canadian donut shop. So maybe the Dunkin' Donuts muffin for the Americans here. But I mean, that muffin alone is 200 to 400 calories. If you walk every single day, you just do 30 minutes every single day. That adds up over 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 10 weeks, 12 weeks. One of the easiest things you can do is add walking to your program, because the last time I checked, not everyone's got a Bowflex. Not everyone's got a 24-hour access to the gym. Not everyone's got the most optimal training program personalized for them, but everybody has a road.
Oh,
You got a
dude,
road, you can walk.
it's so true. And like, I'll be the first one to admit it. I've gotten stuck in the trap when I was a little bit younger and like training people. I would just have these plans that took care of all those things you first started listing, like the tightness here, the weakness here. And I'd be like, oh, I thought it was so genius that I could address all these different things. But then what I found later is like, it's all symptomatic of something else. And it's like, what am I actually trying to solve? Well, I'm trying to solve the fact that this person doesn't move. And it's like, movement is key. Just get going. And then I started noticing the power of it when somebody would like have pain, and then you'd get them moving, and these pains would start going away. Or even if somebody would actually generate some kind of acute pain from a session, it could be like a little back tweak or something like that. And then it's like, hey, I want you just to get on the ground. I want you just to focus on calming your nervous system with some diaphragmatic expansion, just do that kind of stuff. And then just go for a walk. And what happens, it's almost like you're taking the guard off, and the brain's like, hey, we're moving. Everything's moving in accordance. Because it's like, so again, one of the functional things we do. So you're going to get proper pressure. You're going to get things moving in a way that's actually going to calm the nervous system and say this whole flight or flight. It's no longer there. There's no reason for it. Andrew, what are your thoughts, man? When it comes down to seeing people, can you actually see that when you're on the mats? Because that's a more like a functional expression of strength, right? When you're on the mats, can you actually see how people move differently when you know they walk a lot versus somebody who's like, keyboard warrior?
Totally, man. And like when we talk about training and being capable of doing all these movements, like that's where we start as far as training is concerned. And on the mat, if I have someone that I'm rolling against and they're kyphotic and they don't have external rotation in their shoulder, they're gonna tap that much quicker to a movement like that, right? So the same thing exists in jiu-jitsu. And one other thing on the walking, you could safely assume it's an estimate, but per 1,000 steps, you're probably burning 30 to 40 calories. And I know the generic statement of get your 10,000 steps in is said a lot. And I think that kind of creates a space of it's not important and it's not valued. And 10,000 steps, that's 300 to 400 calories right there. And for some people, that's your deficit, right?
Yeah,
So.
absolutely. Vic, you have something to say, man. Just unmute yourself. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I've experimented with 10K walks, and what I want to say about touching on what Amant said, if you track it when you're conditioned, you're going to notice, like, of course, sleep has relevancy here as well if you've slept good. But when you're conditioned, you're going to notice also, like, you're going to reach 10K. And also, like I've noticed, like when I walk with a person, it's generally going faster. If I'm walking by myself, it seems like it's an exercise event. But when you track it, sometimes like you'll notice throughout the walk, maybe you think like you're a little winded. Oh, I must be at 10K. You're not at 10K. You're at 8K. And that's what the tracking kind of actually does, because it gives you like a goal. And sometimes, like, you want to shortchange the goal because of your feelings. And sometimes you know that you can't shortchange the goal because that was your goal. So I like the tracking because of that. And also, I wanted to point out, touching upon what I said earlier, that I like what Ben's preaching is, longevity with the body. People that live in mountainous areas that walk a lot live longer. So there's been studies that shows that longevity is equal to like walking, so in your lifespan. So that's another point too.
Absolutely, man. If Greg was on here, he'd probably say it. But heart health is going to come for us all eventually, right? He said that a bunch of times. That's the thing, right? So yeah, absolutely. And you said something also there that I wanted to touch on, which was that when it comes down to like looking at the difference between intentional movement, like walking versus, hold on, I'm just going to let some people in here. Sorry, I'm new to this. Walking versus zone two. Like you can be intentional with anything, right? Like you see the guys who just go to the gym, that's how they're curling, versus somebody who's in the set and they're actually trying to contract their bicep. They're doing something intentional with movement to try to get a specific result. So same kind of thing. Like, that's why I was saying like no two steps are equal, but you can actually intentionalize them. So separating, and this is something, any guys, if you're doing this is a gold piece of advice here for you. if you're trying to lose weight, if your goal is weight loss and you're trying to substantiate that by step count, maybe don't do that, but do intentional zone two. Intentional zone two being get somewhere where you can actually track your heart rate intentionally, get it to a certain position and hold it for some amount of time. That's very different than walking. Walking is great. I love taking my border collie for a walk. She's an old lady and she needs it. But that is not me being on a stepper for 30 minutes getting steps, right? Because again, totally different thing. I can predict my heart rate, I can keep it there, I can do nasal inhalation, I can get a completely different response. And it can actually, that can help me dig into my sets way different. That can help my leg day later on. It can help get rid of DOMS. There's a lot of different benefits there, right? Did anybody else have any questions about that? Coaches, anything? Michael, I saw you just popped in here. Anybody else have any questions like that or additions?
I think Vic has his hand up. I'm not sure if you can see him, Steve.
Yeah, was it still up, buddy, or was it from the last thing?
Oh man, I need to put it down. So go ahead.
Your hand up.
I'll
You're confusing me. Okay, so the next one is like, this is a big one.
just add a little spice there to people on that whole walking thing. Does that, anyone know where the idea of 10,000 steps a day comes from? It was a campaign from a Tokyo marketer, from Japan, a guy from Japan, and he had a can he was trying to promote pedometers.
No
So
way.
yeah, trying to pr promote pedometers. So the icon or the symbol for 10,000 actually looks like a person walking. So it was just a sign that 10,000 steps is good for your health to sell the pedometers. Okay? But the reality is I think everyone on this call here who either does or knows someone who only does 5,000 steps a day, which you can track with any wearable these days, and anyone who does 10,000, they're different. They're physically different. They look different. They feel different. They are different. So there's no scientific fact around the number of 10,000. However, the number of 10,000 is a no-brainer. You move more than someone who does 5,000. So if you don't know what your baseline is, but you've got a wearable, look it up. It's on your wearable. You can find out under that heart activity icon on your phone. Find out what your average is. And if you want to get healthier, actively do more steps on a daily basis and look to beat that. Our guy Josh, who won Client of the Month this past month, one of the things that I gave him as a challenge was to actually get, I think I said I wanted him to do 100,000 steps in 1 week, however he wants to do them. So that works out to about 15,000, 14,000 a day. And I said, you could do a 20,000 on one day, you could do 10,000 the other. I said, your goal is to get to 100,000. I gave him that. He took it with stride, and he's down 40 pounds in 4 months, and it's because of little things like that. For a guy like him, 5,000 steps a day would still result in probably some weight loss, but not at the extreme levels he got it because he did more work. And an easy way to track that, steps.
That's so cool, Chris. I was actually just talking about that too. Like, it goes back to that intentionality conversation, right? I was talking about like levels of hypertrophy and like the rep counts and stuff like that with the client. And we were talking about how like people argue like, oh, it's like 8 to 12 is best or 1 to 3 is best. And it's like all this stuff, right? And I'm like, hey, listen, like don't put the carriage before the horse. Like we want to make sure that you're working in coordination with what your goal is. That's the thing, the goal. Because I don't think anybody argues. It's like if you do nothing, if you're right now a couch potato, and then you start doing 1 to 3 reps, you're going to get more results than couch potato. That's the point, right? That's always going to be the first thing. And then our job is to get specific. And so it comes down to be like, hey, what's the goal? Because then you can actually say, this is probably the best method for you. So,
Steve,
yeah.
you looked into your magic eight ball. On Monday, there's going to be a Facebook post. I already did it and scheduled, and it's on what is the optimal reps for
There you go. There
hypertrophy.
you
So
go.
everyone check out the Facebook group on Monday.
It's sets of 300 in a pink leotard. All right. So the next thing would be why such an emphasis on tempo and higher reps? So this one I get a lot because obviously like it's a lot, it's different, right? Like we're all bros. We want to lift heavy things. We want to come in here and just like grunt and deadlift 700 pounds and bench press 3 like the golden years. And I think that it's kind of one of those things where you have to be thinking about the things we're trying to accomplish in the first, especially the foundational phase, like the first 6, sometimes it could be forever, but the thing is that the time you're trying to elicit some kind of response to the coach. And usually what I find in terms of my, again, my methods, coaches, please open up after this. I'm doing it usually as like a soft limiter. I'm putting that on a client, so I'm trying to limit them from doing something else so I can get a certain response. I'm trying to make you go slow so you can spend more time in the motion, so you can acquire certain ranges, get into the end ranges, try to feel what you're trying to do, so you can actually get some proprioception as to where your body is in space. Because you can't do that in 1 second. You do a body squat, it's like you have no idea where you went. You're just going to default in the patterns. You're not going to be able to get into the position. If I'm telling you, bring your hamstrings to your calves. Keep your chest up, and I want your pelvis moving vertically. Very different than like, it's not going to have the same effect. So, like, we're thinking about time and attention. It's also something that we can actually think about how, if we look at the difference between like motion versus contraction, motion is like trying to bias into something that's like the path of least resistance. Apparently, I spelt that in like Spanish. But yeah, see. But the thing is, like, path of least resistance versus like contraction, which is like we're trying to make this as hard as possible. I don't want this to be easy on you. Let's go slow. Let's try to actually do this so we can get some intentionality. Anybody who's if you guys have seen Matt yet, Matt has like the most gigantic arms. You guys freaking walking pair of arms. And I don't think I've ever seen him curl anything above 30s. Not that he can. Of course he can. The guy can probably out curl all of us, but he doesn't. And so why is that? It's because he's going slow. He's trying to be with the reps so he can make sure the only thing working is the bicep. And so when we're applying these tempo parameters, it's like, hey, we're trying to do a certain thing that might not be what you think it is. And like those things could be, again, trying to get a certain response, trying to train a certain motion, trying to get you into certain ranges of motion, spending more time in it, all that kind of stuff. And also just gaining some awareness of what's going on because like, and we all have it. I had it the other day. I was doing like an incline bicep curl. And that's why I actually wrote this. My shoulders were lighting up during it. I was like, what is going wrong? But the thing is that what happened is I was able to identify it because I was going slow. And I was like, okay, it's because I was doing this. And I was slightly internally rotated. So I was like, okay, get the shoulder back, breathe, and it's moving. I was like, there we go, went away. And the thing is, if I was going fast, it would be like, oh, it would turn into Arnold from what's that movie where his eyes are bulging? Total Recall. Yeah, I love it. So yeah, coaches, anything like that that you'd share in terms of your methods and why you go slower, why you employ certain tempo parameters for your clients?
Steve, I'll just chime in. More so, I'm always talking about skill acquisition, and I liken training to a sport, right? Just like you're picking up hockey for the first time, basketball, football, we need to learn the fundamentals. We need to learn the foundations of sport and movement. And often we don't think of training like a sport, but it very much is. Like the foundational movement patterns are like a free throw in basketball. Like the squat is your free throw. The hinge is the dribble, right? So it's being able to work on these pieces and being able to slow it down. You can feel your way through it. And it's an awareness tool too, Steve, because people's eyes start to open up. Oh shit, I didn't realize when I was descending into my squat, I really get back on my heels to kind of lose. Or okay, this knee starts to buckle in. They start to also problem solve a bit too. And they're able to give me better information. I can see it in the video. But also they start to pick up on it, or you guys start to pick up on it. I didn't notice that before. I was going way too quick. Or again, not directing tension into muscle, Steve, when you guys are going super quick, it goes into joints and tendinous tissue and ligaments, cartilage where it shouldn't be, and that's where the nagging injuries start to come up. So when we slow it down, we can really feel our way through, contract better. That's a talking point. I always like to go through the skill acquisition piece.
Oh, it's awesome. That's awesome. And you know what's cool is like I think that that's such a polar and a great comparison to how like guy like Chris would do that for like when he's doing powerlifting, because tempo has like an equally valuable but a completely different point of view, right? Like Chris, like tempo is pretty much like the most gigantic thing I've seen you like train with your powerlifting clients.
It just locks in technique. That's what tempo does, because a lot of people accelerate through the points where they're weak, and tempo makes you have to work in every millimeter of the repetition. The benefits for strength training is you get really good at one technique because you spend a lot of time there. The benefits for body composition is you get a crazy muscular pump, and pump is king, and you need that for muscular growth. It's also good for hypertrophy because you have to lower the weights you're using. So you're not going to overload the body and beat up the joints. So for anyone on this call here now, who here trains legs at least once a week? A show of hand. Once a week, you train your legs? Does anyone here train them 2 times a week? Does anyone here train them 3 times a week? You can train legs 3 times a week if you don't beat the shit out of your joints, right? So if one of your trainers, if someone's on this call right now and said, my number one priority is to improve the size of my legs, I would create a program for you to train your legs at least 3 times a week. But I would not be choosing weights that are going to beat up your joints that then require 3 and 4 days to recover, because you're getting more joint pain than muscular pain. That's where things like lightweight, high repetitions, and tempo come into play.
Love it, man. Love it. Vic, go for it, buddy.
Okay, so this question is in referring to planes of motion and like walking. Isn't that like a sagittal, and like it, how it transfers into like agility, I get. But like if your goal is to like lose weight, like and walking's like, aren't you on a sagittal plane when you're walking? And wouldn't it be better to like overall enhance your body to like maybe like instead of just walking? Obviously this is not the only thing that you're doing, but to program like moving in different planes. Does moving in different planes burn more calories than being on a sagittal plane all the time? I would assume so. I just wanted to get somebody's opinion on that.
You know what? Like, I'd love to hear that the coach's opinions on this, but like my opinion of that is it's almost like, I think that what you're going to be referring to is challenge, right? So meaning like if you're an athlete, you're going to probably exist in certain planes better than others. Like if you're a power lifter, everything's very sagittal. If you're, you know, movement oriented, very different. I think that whatever you suck at might be the better thing if you're talking about calorie expenditure. But when we're talking about, if your question's in relation to the first slide, when I was talking about just walking, walking is more of a modality we're choosing for like joint health, again, diaphragmatic expansion, what it's offering the spine, the shoulders, the hips, the knees, the ankles. It's a catch-all. It's such a good thing to employ because we get to conquer so many things in one. Whereas like if we're thinking, hey, I believe that the most functional movement is the squat, I don't know, just because you hear people say that, then you're not going to conquer so many things in the squat. You're not going to get rotation. You're not going to get that at all. You're not going to get as much expansion in certain areas at the right times. Like, so it might be something that'd be really good if you're like, hey, all I want to do is squat. I have no intention of ever walking. I just get on this little this scooter and just move through life. But unless that's you, then it might be something to look into. Does that make sense?
Well, I just don't want that body that I had when I was first, you know, I kind of felt like a little more muscle bound, and kind of like now that I'm older, I don't want that body. And as when I was a trainer, I was moving in different planes of motion. That's why, like, once I became more intelligent about my muscle, pardon the pun, I just basically did that. And then I realized that when I was like encountering like a sparring match or stuff like that, I could sidestep better. I could just, I was better. And versus like when I was like a power lifter or a bodybuilder, I was just like goofy. And compared to like being training in all these different movement patterns, and I just felt better overall. Yeah. That's what I was going for.
Yeah. So like I would, in that kind of situation, I'd look at it.
Burned a lot of calories too. So yeah.
Yeah. I think I would look at like just time spent as a natural, like just equation for everything. Meaning like if you spend your time doing one thing, then you're going to become that thing. Right. If you look at all these power lifters, like, I don't know, if you look at like strongmen, it's probably a better thing to say strongmen, because a lot of power lifters are actually changing these days, but a lot of strongmen, they walk in a certain pattern, like externally rotated in here with the shoulders. They just have this pattern to them. And I think that's because, well, I don't think, but they, you know, they do their craft and they do it all the time. They're not spending time in positions that like a yoga instructor would. And if you look at the general qualities of yoga instructor, that's very different too. Like I went down to Montreal a couple weekends ago for the Metallica concert, and I got tickets for Cirque du Soleil of all things for the day between the concerts. And Cirque was so cool. It was a cool experience for me to see, because you see these different athletes in a completely different realm. And there's these little, do you guys know what I mean by the little bungee cord guys? They hold onto these bungee cords and they go up and they're like, Johnny, I know you do. But like those guys are just like spiraling around. They're phenomenal. But it's really cool to see that like every single person who had a different job and a different kind of criteria there, they all had different body style. They all moved different. They all stood different. Their posture was different because of what they did. So again, time spent in positions is going to dictate that, right? So I think what you're saying, it's just like when you spend time doing a thing, if you look at bodybuilding as an example of that, what do we spend our time doing? Contracting. We're not really, yes, we spend time lengthening, but to contract, and you're just contracting under greater loads. If you look at yoga, yoga is just extension, right? We're looking at that as like a way to express bodily function in these expressed or these extension motions. So like the two body styles are very different. You can even just picture, I bet you any money, if I was to grab all your thoughts, and if you all thought yoga instructor, you'd have the exact same image in your head. And if you said powerlifter, same image, because you can see what the body looks like after spending that much time in that motion. Is that kind of where your brain's going?
Yeah, that's why a boxer, can destroy a bodybuilder most of the times in a fight, because they're moving around in all these different planes of motion. And the boxer, I mean, his movement is pattern is higher to a higher degree than the person who's just been in that same plane all the time. Yep. They may have, I mean, if that bodybuilder gets him, like it's lights out, but.
Maybe, right? Because the thing is, even then, like that's why Ben talks a lot about how we design programs around isolation. You need to isolate muscles to make them grow. It's hypertrophy. But then we want to make sure we're incorporating functional movement, because otherwise functional movement, if it's lost, you start getting pain, you become dysfunctional. You see it all the time. I've seen a lot of guys, I'm sure you guys have too, where they bodybuilders who think they're athletes, but they're just like the bro bodybuilders. They're not functional. Then they go do something, they tear their ACL. Like it was like the stupidest thing. Like I chased a chicken, knee gone. It's like, what? How did that happen so quickly? Because they think they're athletes, but they're not doing anything functional. They spent their whole life in a leg extension. It's like, that's not the point of this, right? It's kind of a little weird.
Can I chime in on this one for a sec, Stevie?
Yeah, buddy.
So Vic, I think I understand your question. I came in like right after you finished, but I think I understand the question. So two things I want you to think about. If maintaining a high degree of functionality is your goal, the first and most important thing, and this kind of goes in order, like you have to do one before you can do the other. And the first and most important thing is end range control. And so like, if you want to have high levels of mobility, high levels of the ability to control your body, right? Then it's end range control. And so when you're talking about powerlifters, the reason they become muscle bound or bodybuilders become muscle bound is because they don't explore and control the ends of the range of motion. They're very short and very lengthened position, bottom of a squat, bottom of a lunge, really short position in a row, really lengthened position, things like that. First, get strong in those positions and recognize your body's natural tendency to avoid those positions. And so the first thing is, and the reason you need to do that is because if you don't go to those positions, you lose the ability to control it there. And the body at a nervous system level tightens up as a protective mechanism. So if you want to avoid tightness, you train end ranges. That's the first thing. The second thing that comes up, you guys are talking about boxers versus bodybuilders. Well, here's a really, really useful framework to think about. Bodybuilding is all what we call top-down motor control. Brain controls body. I tell my bicep, contract, right? That's top-down. Sports is bottom-up, which means it's reflexive. It's like my body is telling my brain where I am in space. If I throw you a ball, you catch it. It's reflexive, right? Provided you don't have a huge amount of time to like think about it. If I throw you something that's reflexive, the nervous system naturally does it in a reflexive way. So the reason people lose athleticism is they train only in the mechanism of top down, meaning I'm going to contract my quads really aggressively. I'm going to contract my hamstrings and my delts, the bodybuilding style. If you want to maintain the dynamic nature of the muscles, you must also train bottom up. The thing I recommend most people do to do this is, kettlebells are a great idea. Believe it or not, the thing I'm suggesting to all my guys right now, if you have space in your yard, buy a trampoline. Trampoline is an incredible way to teach your body how to reflexively contract muscles, but not necessarily in an aggressive way. It's in just enough of a way to allow yourself to bounce. That would be another great way to start incorporating reflexive type training, and like plyometrics as an example, right? But plyometric for most people for many people is too complex.
Sunil, I think you had your hand up, buddy.
Yeah. I had a message exchange with Andrew a couple of weeks ago about he's programmed mainly this is for you, Andrew, because we only talk through Telegram, maybe for you to answer, but how do I put this? So we were talking about fast twitch and slow twitch fiber movement. So most of my programming is in slow tempo, but one of the workouts is the leg day. Have seven rounds of three reps explosive movements at like 35-45% max weight. So that's like fast twitch, right? It's explosive. So it's just a general question, right? If you talk about slow tempo, but mixing it with these explosive movements is, how does it work? Like you've got to get the slow tempo to build muscle and so focus on the movement quality.
Just for a quick clarity, Sunil, the term fast twitch and slow twitch is misleading. Slow twitch doesn't necessarily mean it's lightweight. It just means it's a lower threshold. So a good way to think of it, like fast twitch tends to be a higher threshold. So as an example, if you're curling a soup can, you know, it's not a high threshold for muscles. It's like a very low threshold of required muscle contraction. It's not a lot of demand. That's a better way to think of it. So when you're training these lower threshold motor units, it tends to be with lower intensities, lower levels of effort. And then when you train these higher threshold, which is fast twitch, that require, typically most people associate it, well, if I lift heavier, I'm going to have to train a higher threshold. However, you can also hit the high threshold motor units, which is the fast twitch, through fatigue. So if you're fatiguing something, all of a sudden the threshold that's required of you as far as effort goes up, right? So if you're doing sets of 20 and 15 through 20 are really challenging for you, you're also recruiting these higher threshold motor units. So it's not necessarily just about weight or reps.
Okay, so maybe I was just through the message with Andrew, I was kind of interpreting this, but yeah, maybe it was two different topics. So I think what I was trying to understand in terms of the rationale behind the programming is when you put in fast tempo mixed in with a program of mainly slow tempo, like Andrew's done like squats at the beginning of the leg day, but then on, let's say, upper body day, it's like push-ups, just finish, do a whole lot of push-ups, as many as you can at the end of the workout. So right. Is it just like safety of the movement with squats?
That's a different question. So I understand what you're saying. Andrew can chime in and answer this question. I'll give you my sense, and Andrew can explain his reasoning for it. So when you're training something that's heavier with a faster tempo, it's usually more of a focus because of the less total amount of, so if you think of it in terms of duration of time under tension, right? Duration of tension. So something that's shorter duration, but higher intensity tends to be less stimulating to the muscle and more stimulating to the connective tissue and the nervous system. So it's a strength adaptation, fast reps, low reps, strength adaptation. Slow repetitions, longer durations, tends to be more of a one metabolic adaptation, which is going to be more energy demanding, or two, a muscular demand. So think of it like a continuum. At this end of the continuum is very nervous system dominant, really short amount of time, high amount of intensity. This end of the continuum is very long amount of time, very low amount of intensity, but extend over a long period of time. On this end is, I just need to place a greater energy demand on my system. Like if I do something that's a set of 30 or 40, the body just keeps going, oh man, I have to produce energy fast. You actually literally increase the rate of energy production. Does that make sense? See how those are different? So they both have a huge benefit, just like kind of a different objective. Andrew, you can answer specifically why you did what, but that's just the logic for them.
The only other thing I'd add on top of that is partly just managing for recovery across the week. So being able to train fast and keep the load a little bit lighter just to manage and still expose you to some more leg training across the week, Sunil. Because that's been a component where you've shared having a hard time recovering from leg sessions, right?
Yeah, so faster tempo, is it less taxing on the nervous system? If you go low weight, fast tempo, I guess it's just, lower stress in both ways. It's lower weight and lower speed. Higher speed, so you just get through it quicker. And slow tempo is higher demand on the nervous system, right? Is that
and just overall athleticism, just exposing you to it. Like we've spent a good amount of time focusing on time under tension, pausing on the bottom, making sure that you're stable. And to Victor's point a little bit earlier, we were talking about sport and change of direction and different motion, being able to introduce some speed in there for sure.
And can both approaches build muscle, or is what the strength approach more about? It won't build size, but it's strength. I hear about this kind of debate about hypertrophy and strength, where you can get stronger but not bigger. Does that play into it at all?
Can you say that again? What is the question exactly, Sunil?
Well, sometimes I've read that there's like a certain rep range where you get stronger but you don't get bigger. So is that like a different? That's where I was asked, maybe thinking about slow twitch, fast twitch, where you. I was thinking about marathon runners versus sprinters, where, you know, marathon runners like have, what is it, slower twitch fibers, but it's very skinny, or like look and versus sprinters.
Yeah, no, that's confusing. So the way you get stronger without getting bigger is with very heavy weights without a huge amount of volume. So you keep your volume low, right? And you get so basically the way muscle building happens from the accumulation of metabolites, the accumulation of these metabolites as a byproduct of muscle building in combination with end-to-end pulling on the muscle. So you need both. So you need this tension that's happening in the muscle in combination with metabolites. So if you minimize the metabolites, if you minimize the amount of metabolic response, then there's less of a hypertrophy response, and calories matter, right? So think of like there's a mechanical nature of muscle and there's a biochemical nature of muscle. So mechanical is like there needs to be end-to-end pulling on these two muscles, on these two bones is very, very high. And there's a biochemical nature, which is like hormones and myokines and other secretory molecules that ultimately lead to growth. Is that confusing, or does that clarify?
Yeah, this time of night in the UK, yeah, it's too. I'll stop there, I think. Yeah, but I think it's it's a lot more to it, right? So that's what I'll take away.
We'll talk further, brother.
I'll do some reading, as you know. I read the books on this stuff, and the other thing, I listened to an audiobook. Sorry to dominate this side of it, but I'm listening to an audiobook about functional training today, and something about kettlebells or ballistic training. Is that ballistic training as a concept? Is that something? I don't know. What are your thoughts?
You know, everyone uses different terminology. Sometimes I'm like, I don't know what that means. They're like, oh, it means this. Like, okay, everyone, because you know, everyone tries to come up with their own guru status by naming things. And I'm like, what does that mean exactly? What are you trying to say, right? So I don't know. Maybe it's ballistic. Maybe that just means the absence of. So when I think of ballistic, I would say, overcoming the inertial properties of the muscle, right? So or of the weight, not the muscle. Sorry. So like, trying to minimize inertia. You're trying to like float. So rather than like, whereas bodybuilding would be more tension oriented, something that ballistic would be like, I'm trying to minimize tension. Do I listen? Oh, there.
Cool. Thank you.
Does anyone else have a feedback on the word ballistic and its meaning to you guys? All right. Vic. Sorry, man. Let me take over. Mr. TV. He's still yours, man.
Oh, no, no. Yeah, I love it. So why it's here. Vic, go for it, buddy.
Yeah, so I think about things that are Ben quotes, and I think about what he says, like, if you can't do it anymore, you must do it. And I'm bringing this exercise up because it's kind of been an exercise that I love and hate at the same time, and it's the deadlift, okay? And it's probably going to be the compound movement that is going to benefit me the most. And it taxes my CNS. And, I'm very like strong in other things. Like for instance, I could swim for like more than an hour. And I know people that can't do that. And like, and I get frustrated because like I think of like maybe like my breathing patterns or just like I'm defeating myself. Something's going on when I squat where like I'm just not able to do it, deadlift. I'm not able to do it in a controlled manner, and I just I feel that I'm lacking. And
well, dude, they're so far from being the same thing. And so the way I would think about this for you, Vic, the thing that can, so when you say you're not able to do it, does that mean like you're out of breath? Does that mean your back hurts? I mean, you can't get to the floor. What exactly does that mean?
Well, everybody gets taxed their CNS when they do deadlifts. It's just that I think to the point of the question, it's just like, you know, why is it like my hardest exercise of all?
How do you define hard?
Well, it's the one that like just beats me up the most, Ben. That's what I mean. It's just
so,
after
so,
I do
so
that,
define what that means. So like that again, I don't
exhausting.
Like general.
Exhausting, and it's
so
just it's
during,
just like
so,
after that, I don't want to do any more exercises.
So during yeah. or like immediately after or like 2 hours later, which are all very different.
During. No, right. I never quit, but it's like then I start thinking, man, I got to get through the next of this workout, and it's like, oh my god, as soon as I see the deadlift, everything after the, you know, my form and function and this and that, it all kind of like dissipates. But before the deadlift, I'm like, you know, I'm good. But it's why I said the CNS, you know, I feel like
I'm can you come to camp in September? I could in 3 minutes, 3 to 4 minutes, I guarantee I could make your deadlift more effective. And you'd be like, oh, this feels great. I don't feel as gassed. So what you're doing with I've never seen you deadlift, but what I'm going to guess you're doing is over compressing your diaphragm. So if your mobility through your hips is not very good, maybe your mobility through your abdomen and waist isn't very good, and you compress. So if I'm sitting here in a chair and I'm compressed down, my diaphragm goes. So now my breathing apparatus is going boom, and it can't. And so I end up breathing up here. So my ability to exchange oxygen with my lungs and with the environment is much decreased. So your breathing efficiency goes way down, like fractional. So while you're swimming, you're like, oh, I'm really lengthened and I can swim like this and my diaphragm is nice and long and I'm feeling really great. And I'm getting all this oxygen because I'm extending. Whereas when you're compressing, it's a completely different game. You're compressing your spine, you're compressing your thorax, your body's going, I got no room to put oxygen in there. So you just need to learn how to brace effectively and how to not compress your spine. Or not when I say not compress your spine, not like flex into your spine. September 22nd, like 1 month from this week, September 22nd through the 24th, come to camp. It's in Toronto. It's worth it, man. It'll change your life.
Vic, for what it's worth, what Ben just said is gold, man. Like when I used to squat, I was just ever, when I had a back injury a long time ago, I was so concerned with that coming back, right? And it sits in your identity for a little while. So I was always doing everything to keep it away. So I was over concerned with this, trying to brace. And so my back squat looked like a hunchback. Luckily, my shoulders, it kind of worked because I have a lot of shoulder mobility. So I was like, eh, and I can put the bar there. And so I never really thought of it being an issue. But then I like a set of a plate, I'd be like, oh. Meanwhile, anything else didn't wind me. And then it took some learning to understand like your thoracic spine is not your lumbar spine. It's like, yeah. And then I could understand like, hey, lengthen the system, understand the cues individually. And then once I did, that no longer felt like a marathon and I could actually do a set. And I was like, oh, this feels great now. And it actually turned into movement I liked. So it's really cool. Coaches, Andrew, Chris, are you still on here, buddy? I saw you leave.
He's here.
Yeah. And Johnny, did you guys have a question that you brought up? So we only got 5 minutes left. I want to make sure that I give you guys some time to talk about it, if there was something. Andrew?
I did, but I almost want to piggyback what we were talking about a second ago, just because I feel like it's relevant and I feel like it ties in a personal example for me from a podcast that happened with Dr. Stuart McGill 2 weeks ago at this point. I think if you guys haven't listened to it, it's worth going back and listening for sure. And to Vic's question earlier, talking about the comparison, I think it, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was kind of equating planes of motion to effort and which one being the better workout. And what I can say about jujitsu, for someone, even if they have an extremely high level of fitness and they have zero exposure to jujitsu, they are going to leave extremely gassed because they have no technique and they've never been exposed to it, right? It's the same with planes of motion. One of the simplest ways or most common ways to get injured is taking someone that's been a previous athlete who takes a hiatus for 6 months to a year, and they try and jump right back in to that level of performance. That is a recipe for injury, right? But like for myself, my background being in football, I never spent, there was no need for me to spend any time with my spine flexed or being able to tuck my chin and be able to roll like I do in jiu-jitsu while I was playing football. So when I first started jiu-jitsu, you could almost think like my spine was almost, when they told me to front roll, it was like a domino hitting the ground. Like my spine just was not, my nervous system, I was not capable of being in that position. Now it's almost like you roll an orange across the dinner table and that's what I'm capable of doing on the mat now. But that took time for sure, right? But coming back to that question again real quick, Vic, is if you have a higher level of expertise, again, like with sports, it's, there's so many components that go into it as far as, it's equated to effort as far as which one's going to be the harder workout. I could play basketball with seventh graders and destroy them and play at a 2 out of 10 effort versus a pickup basketball game with some people at the same level. And it's going to be a different type of training, we'll say.
Dude, I can't not think of your face on an orange. When he said that, I just thought of like, I thought of, yeah, sorry.
So the takeaway was, Andrew, be wary of trying to train all those different planes because that's kind of a more advanced thing, and just be like thinking of that as a more advanced thing, because I was thinking like, you know, that, hey, that's maybe like the way to go, more akin to like, you know, body functionality. Versus
no,
like,
no.
Yeah.
We right. want to be capable of doing all those things for sure. There might just be, it comes down to your schedule and the time commitment, right? It might be smarter to prioritize one thing currently versus another thing. But to Ben's point earlier, including things, simple things like having a trampoline around, things that are just easily and readily available to expose you to some of those different positions. And to kind of take your mind off it a little bit too, right? So for some people that hate the mobility, that know that they need the mobility, like find something that you're going to be able to stick to.
Vic, if I can just chime in here for 1 second, just to kind of bring you a thought you can sit with, is like, I remember asking a guy I knew, he was a coach for a long time as well. We were asking him about things like tight quads and stuff. This is a while back. And I was like, oh, my quads are always tight. Give me suggestions. And he's like, for what? And I kind of didn't understand because I was like, give me a solution. And he just is like, for what? And I'm like, for my tight quads. What are you talking about? And he's like, well, but why? What's going on? Like, why are you tight there? Why do you feel like, that was the coolest question. He's like, why do you feel you need more mobility? I'm like, well, I don't know. I didn't have an answer. I was kind of like, I kind of just don't want to have tight quads. And so I didn't really understand why he just wouldn't fix it. But then it dawned on me. I was like, if I'm not spending time in positions that require a certain range of motion, what's the point of me trying to do this, right? Like, if you're not going to be an Olympic weightlifter, what's the point of you trying to squat with your hands over your head? If you're not going to be rolling on the mats like Andrew, what's the point of you trying to gain the range of motion? I think that the question should be kind of like solve reverse engineering from the goal you're trying to achieve. If you're trying to, you know, grow muscle, then I think it would be more advantageous to spend time in positions that are going to be helping you do that. Right? That's where my brain would go, to try to solve backwards so you can understand
what you're trying to achieve. I look at that differently, man. I look at like, I want to be able to do everything, right? I'm like, I want to be able to do it all. And if I can't, then I see that as a deficiency. I'm like, something's wrong.
Do you think you can though? And that's like, do you think you can? Like, cause it's really hard, right?
No, well, I can't do everything at a world-class level, but you certainly can't do everything at a world-class level, but you can do everything at a very, very proficient level. I think you're CrossFitters, right? Like they're very capable in kind of everything. That's really, I think, that's why CrossFit is successful, is because it's just requiring you to do all these crazy things.
Yeah, because it's a funny question, right? Because like, I know that like when I don't even if I just train like weightlifting like once, twice a week, I lose the mobility necessary to do certain things, right? And it drops quickly. So I can imagine like for people trying to even just get in that position where you squat and put your arms up.
Well, let's talk about that. Hold on. So I just want to understand what you said. Did you say that when you do weightlifting a couple times a week, you lose the mobility?
Oh, when I only do it a couple times a week.
Got it. Interesting. So the way I look at it, man, this is really interesting kind of personal anecdotal experience. The more effectively I train, the less mobility work I need. So if I train really, really well and I'm controlling my reps and I'm lengthening muscles and I'm contracting muscles, I almost don't need any mobility work and I almost don't need any dynamic work. My body just is able to control all the ranges I put it into and I feel athletic. I can run, I can jump. My mobility is exceptional. When I start doing dumb shit in the gym, like going outside of the range I can control, trying to exceed what my body currently is able to do, that's when I start to tighten up. It's really, I get more mobility from weight training, and this is not an exaggeration. I get way more mobility from weight training, intelligent weight training, than I ever have in my life from yoga, for sure. I leave yoga often feeling like stretched, but not more mobile. But I leave weight training more mobile because I'm gaining end range control. And that was a big paradigm flip for me. Like, I'm trying to prove myself wrong, but every time I do it, I just prove myself right.
No, I love that. The slide we'll have to do another time that I was going to talk about is kind of like that, was like stretching, right? In terms of understanding like the point of that. And yoga is, I think people misuse that all the time, just in terms of what they're trying to gain from it. It's like, if you're trying to get strong.
Yeah, I don't look at yoga like stretching anymore. I look at like end range control. I'm like, put me in a position that I can't go into, make me stay there for 5 breaths, and I have to be really, really calm.
Yeah.
That's it.
So I'm a big CrossFit fan because of the fact is that, you know, I feel that repetitive motions put you in a position where you're more injury prone and
not repetitive motions, uncontrolled repetitive motions, to use your term, ballistic. Or maybe it was someone, Sunil's term.
Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, there's a difference. My analogy, I've never been a CrossFitter, but like I worked for my brother. I was a painter, and I equate to like my injury with the shoulder, because painters use their shoulders a lot, to like, you know, the time that I spent as a painter. And I know that, you know, I was lifting weights and I never got injured lifting weights in the gym, but I became a painter and I injured my shoulder. So like that repetitive motion, that's why I kind of see CrossFit as, maybe I'm missing the point of CrossFit, but I see them doing like the same things and over again, and they're doing the muscle ups and stuff. And I look at that as like repetitive motion, whereas that's damaging. Whereas like I want to heal my body and train my body versus,
you know, man, repetitive motion is not the problem, but repetitive motion that exceeds what you're currently capable of doing to an excess will become, like, repetitive motion is required to make progress, right? But just when you exceed what your body is currently able to control, that's when things happen. Repetitive motion, no, it's not. So this is a misnomer in terminology. They talk about overuse injuries. Overuse injuries are not a thing. Misuse injuries are a thing. Overuse is not real, right? I do a million steps a week, and I do 1,000 leg extensions a week. And like that, I don't get overuse injuries, but if I do something stupidly, I'll get a misuse injury.
Yeah. There's some people that have no business doing kipping pull-ups based on their upper body mobility
or clean and jerks. Yeah,
absolutely. And, you know, doing 50 kipping pull-ups versus me giving someone 50 strict pull-ups, like the level of risk for injury and to earn the right to be able to do the next thing, you have to have the range of motion. If you don't, that's your limiting factor.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. One thing I wanted to kind of invite people to do, because I know that we're short on time and I'm cool to talk to everybody, but I actually wanted to use this as a segue for everybody who's involved in the Facebook chat to drop these kind of questions in. But that's why we're here, right? Like, us coaches want to be in there and answering these questions. So if you guys have questions kind of like this, kind of like what I've been bringing up, like just questions that you know that you're just not alone on with what you're wondering, drop them in the Facebook so we can kind of get more involved. Not only the Telegram chat, because I find that sometimes the Telegram chat, like there's a lot and we can get lost in information. It's like, where was that? And yeah, if we have something that we can kind of all pop in, because if somebody like addresses something like, hey, does stretching work? We can all pop in and give our own anecdotal advice or anything like that we can try to help you with. But yeah, did anybody else have anything that they would like to share? Michael, Johnny,
I'm going to share one thing real quick. I recorded a podcast today, one of my favorite ones that I've ever recorded, specifically around hormone optimization, with the guy who's the head of the International Hormone Society in Belgium. Man, listen to it. It'll be out probably in a couple of weeks. But we really spoke about the benefits of hormone optimization for really everyone. But certainly he believes everyone over the age of 30 probably has some benefit or would yield significant benefit from some hormone replacement. Really, really, and this isn't just testosterone. We talked about growth hormone. We talked about thyroid. We talked about IGF-1. We talked about estrogen. We talked about vasopressin. We talked about a bunch of stuff. So I'm pumped to share that one with you guys. That'll be coming out soon. And yeah, as Stevie said, do what you can to be active in the Facebook group. We're actually going to be doing our best to continually add more value in there for you guys, add more really useful content just to get you guys some more support and some more value.
And who's the podcast with, just so I can check it out when it comes out?
If I told you his name, you're not going to remember anyways.
All right.
It's Dr. Thierry Hertog.
Thierry Hertog. Maybe I will. It's a little different.
I'll type it in the chat because it's worth it. So he actually is giving away, 30% discount. He's got a 642-page testosterone book. I'll type it. I think I might have misspelled his name, but I think that H at the end might not be there. But awesome. I'm sure there's not more than one. Yeah, really, really good podcast. Actually, so you guys all know I'm doing a series right now on testosterone, all the best doctors in the world in testosterone. I would understand all of, not just testosterone, but all hormones. Yeah, great, great information. I did one with Jay Campbell as well. All right, everybody. I know it's late. You guys go enjoy the rest of your evening. Steve, thank you for leading today. Michael, Johnny, Chris, Andrew, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Everybody else, thanks for being here.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Bye.